Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking about justice deferred is justice denied. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and honestly, Martin, he's wearing a Slytherin hoodie, boys and girls, and the most reptilian look on his face. You literally are one squash nose away from Voldemort.
Yes, I know. And a happy new year to you too, Tony. Glad to be back in the tortoise shack after our short break.
Well, yeah, well, I think we had about a 9-hour break.
Yeah, yeah, that was it.
Oh, look, much more importantly, we are delighted. And I mean, genuinely delighted to be joined by Dr. Maeve O'Rourke, who was I was fortunate a few weeks ago to sit down and see Maeve speak to a crowd about human rights, about advocating for people, about the work she done with the Irish Council of Civil Liberties, more importantly around the work that she did advocating for, the award-winning work she did for advocating for the Magdalen laundries and trying to I said at the beginning, justice deferred is justice denied. Some of that, you know, the success and the failures of that. Maeve, I'm absolutely thrilled to have you in this tortoise shack.
Thanks. I'm delighted as one of your new subscribers as well. to be using your new equipment.
That See, I'm if you for. Subscribe, there is a chance that you get on as a guest. Now, I'm only saying that to anybody who's listening to this pod. Okay, that's it.
No, I think it's great that look, obviously thanks so much for that, and it's great and we are delighted. I hope people actually are experiencing much better sound quality because I've had good feedback and I think people are thinking it's working out well. But just back to your own work. Now, I'm going to start off by you in Harvard and you were there.
Yeah.
And you realized that you needed to go home. Do you want to tell that little vignette for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. I graduated from UCD Law School in 2009 with my undergrad degree in law. I'd always really been interested in human rights. But I definitely, on looking back now, can see that we were very much focused on human rights abuses in other countries. And I'd also, you know, on top of that, had gone through secondary school engaging in human rights, I think, more with a view to what was happening abroad as well. Maybe we did look at social justice issues, but we didn't see them in human rights terms. So my point is that by the time I finished in UCD, I was thinking, I want to work in human rights. I'm going to work if I can at the UN. And it was 2009 that I was going to Harvard in August. And that summer was the summer that the Ryan Report was published. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people now that I would teach would be far too young to even know what that is, unfortunately, which is one of the issues that I'll come to. It's so important that we ensure that this history is put into the regular primary and secondary school curriculum. But it was 2009, the Ryan Report came out, and I remember watching the questions and answers show that was on either the night that it came out or the day afterwards, and there were politicians on the panel, and one of the people from the audience grabbed the microphone, and it was Michael O'Brien, a Fianna Fáil councillor. Yes. And it's a moment that a lot of people will never forget, I think. And I'd been reading in the newspaper the findings of the Ryan Commission, but it really wasn't until you saw him speak. It was just like heart stopping and devastating. And really, you know, I remember not really being able to speak after seeing him talk. And he just said to those politicians, "You don't know what I suffered. The woman beside me, she's the only one who understands. I still wake up in the middle of the night and I see him in his collar at the end of the bed and he's going like this." And he was kind of wagging his finger. He talked about how all of his siblings had been gathered up by the cruelty man, which is what people called the ISPCC officer. And they'd all been separated out into different industrial schools. So anyway, I was lost for words, and I remember saying to my dad, who was also watching the program, "I don't know why I'm going anywhere to work on human rights." So when I got to Harvard, I happened to be studying sex equality. I was really interested in women and children's rights. And I was studying sex equality with a professor, Catherine McKinnon, who's a very famous radical feminist lawyer. And I went to her in office hours pretty early on in my year of the master's, and I was trying to come up with something to say to her. And I suppose even in the early weeks of her course on sex equality, and she's very radical, and it was all about questioning everything and seeing patriarchy everywhere. And I had done this paper for her class on how Ireland was reckoning with its legacy of church-related abuse. And some of the gender aspects that I'd picked out were that the Magdalene laundries hadn't been included. Also that the compensation and the kind of acknowledgement of what had happened to boys versus girls was different. Sexual abuse was compensated more highly, but then naked beatings of girls was considered physical, not sexual abuse. So the things that nuns had done to girls that definitely had sexual elements weren't recognised as such. And there was kind of this idea that this is abuse that happened in the past. It's like exceptional. This kind of thing doesn't happen anymore. We don't leave boys in the hands of priests on their own anymore. So we can all just see it as something that happened in the past and move on. So that was all part of my analysis of, you know, based on what I was learning with her. But I went to office hours, was trying to come up with something to say. It was very early on. I was quite intimidated, I suppose, being in her presence. And, I just told her about how I'd been looking at the Magdalene laundries. I'd realized that the play that we'd all studied for secondary school for the Leaving Cert on Tyrrell was real. There was just, I remember where I was sitting in her sex equality class one day when I realized, oh my God, like that was real. Those women are still alive. Women who were in Magdalene laundries, if they're still alive, never have got a pension. They haven't had an apology. And I was saying all this to her and she just stared at me and said, what are you going to do about it? So, the environment in Harvard was one where the students there really expected themselves to be making the law, not just necessarily applying it.
Yeah.
You know, like legislating, all the classes were not just about what the law is. That was almost like your own homework. The actual lectures were all about what was the economic intent of this law? What is the history? Who put these judges in charge? What are the politics? How could the law be changed? Is it achieving its aim? It was all about like, is this the right law? Should we have another law? What are you going to do about this situation? How would you change it? So when she said like, what are you going to do about it? She really meant it. So I wrote my master's thesis on the Magdalene laundries, on the state's responsibility for human rights violations, and particularly its failure to prevent forced labour, servitude or slavery. The fact that those had been human rights violations recognised by Ireland in the 1930s when we had ratified International Labour Organization conventions and, of course, our constitution dating from 1937, like these were the most basic human rights violations. So it wasn't a case of seeing them just by today's standards as being wrong. And I suppose I just took things from there. I mean, when I was researching, I couldn't find anything that had been written from a legal perspective about the Magdalene laundries. And no, that is 2009. So it's not even that long ago. Nothing. I had the whole of the Harvard library at my disposal, but there wasn't legal analysis. There was even very little witness testimony and evidence. So I got tapes from RTE of a phone-in of Joe Duffy over a couple of days in 2009 after the Ryan Report came out and people started calling in saying, well, my mum was in a Magdalene laundry or I was in a Magdalene laundry. Why weren't we included? We never got paid. You know, my relative never got out. And I transcribed all of that. There was one chapter in the Ryan Report that talked about residential laundries, but it didn't name Magdalene's. And obviously we've come to know now, you know, even the way we've dealt with the Magdalene laundries is insufficient because there were laundries in a lot of the mother and baby homes. There were laundries attached to a lot of the industrial schools. And then there were also these voluntary children's institutions that weren't regulated industrial schools, but were places where children were kept and they all did laundry as well. Yeah. So the testimony, yeah. So it was very little, but there was something in the Ryan Report. And then there had been a Channel 4 documentary, Sex in a Cold Climate. And I watched that back and transcribed what the women had been saying, but nothing had aired on Irish television about the Magdalene laundries either. And this was 2009. I mean, relatively recent.
The issues that you're dealing with, would it be fair to call that the structural violence of the state towards people?
Yeah, that's the exact point about human rights violations. And, you know, these days, actually, the way that human rights were set up legally is, you know, very insufficient to deal with corporate human rights violations, but in their traditional sense and still the way that you actually enforce them in law, human rights violations are things that the state does. And so I was focusing, and also because the state has the power, of course, to ensure redress, to ensure accountability, it has the powers to compel the production of evidence, to prosecute, to hold investigations. It is important to focus on the state. So in the case of my master's thesis, I focused on forced labour. But as the years went on, and as I worked more with the Voluntary Justice for Magdalene's group, and as I took more testimony from women who'd spent time in Magdalene laundries, I, of course, focused on a far greater range of human rights violations. Torture, of course, cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment. I mean, I really feel that torture was systematically perpetrated in Magdalene laundries, particularly because it was an indefinite experience. So when I speak to women, I think that the thing that, you know, affected them most, but of course in my very untrained, you know, not professional psychological opinion, but they all say that they believed that they would die in there. So everything that was happening to them was something that they believed was going to happen to them until the day that they died. And then that they would be put in an unmarked grave without a funeral, because they were seeing older women, you know, in beds next to them dying, in the places where they were working, dying.
And that is institutionalized fear. That's a fear that goes beyond the Magdalene itself, but goes out to society, that there was nothing out there in society that could save them. Nothing.
No, and that nobody cared. So one of the things that a lot of women speak about is writing letters and finding after they, if they escaped to Magdalene, finding that their letters had never been sent to the family members, and then being told that no one had written to them, that no one wanted to come and see them, but actually finding out if they did manage to escape, the family members had tried to visit. So, and that again, that sense of self that they lost in there, that again, if they escaped, continued to affect them for the whole of their lives, that sense of self-esteem, of self-worth. And really today, when we talk about redress and what it means, it's about dignity. It is about the fundamental notion that you are somebody that this should not have happened to, and that you are somebody that deserves an accounting, just like any of us would expect an accounting if we were abducted, put into slavery, and like threatened with being dumped in a unmarked grave. At the end of the day.
Is there, like, we know that women were put into Magdalene laundries by their own families. Is that the element that's missing, is that there was nobody there to rescue them? Even if they did manage to save themselves, there was nowhere to go. You couldn't go back home. What could you do? You were stuck in this cycle where the guards would turn you over, your family would dob you in, the local priest was the first one out after you, the people shut their doors, they shunned you. It was an entire society that was involved in this.
I mean, Ireland sounds like it was a terrifying place for a lot of women and girls, and there are a lot of women who escaped to England who I have met who still find it very scary to be back home, and they come back to Ireland, but they know that it's not a rational fear, but they do actually feel a fear. After a few days, I know a woman who says, you know, I just say to my husband, you have to take me home, because she gets worried that she'll be captured again. I think that, yes, family members did put girls and women into Magdalene laundries, although perhaps not as frequently as the state would like us to believe. There was pure abduction, frequently by state bodies, by these semi-state kind of lay organisations. The McAleese report on the state's involvement with the Magdalene laundries has this whole category of entries into the Magdalene laundries that it categorises as neither state nor non-state, which again is an issue we have today. What is the status of the voluntary organisations that the state outsources its functions to? So like the Legion of Mary acted as social workers until there were official social workers. What is the status of the ISPC? then there were a lot of girls just transferred directly from industrial schools into Magdalen Laundries. And there were a lot of women who'd left industrial schools, but because as a child in an industrial school, they usually wouldn't have had family connections upon getting out. The nuns would then have a finger on them and they would, you know, be putting them into places to work. And that meant that there was still kind of surveillance happening. And if they went on a date, for example, they might find themselves the next day in a Magdalen laundry. I know a woman who spoke to a man, the undertaker in the morgue of the hospital she was working in, and the next day was up on the altar arranging flowers, and nuns came in from the two side doors and the back one of the church and grabbed her, and she was put into a Magdalen laundry. And one of the things, you know, accountability is...
This is terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Like, accountability is completely missing.
That's what I was going to bring you to. We haven't gotten there.
The Mackley's report actually said, well, actually, what the women didn't know was, until 21, girls were on licence, and the manager of an industrial school could actually recall them at any time for their own protection and put them wherever they wanted.
But who put them on licence?
That is, like, not...
Who decided that somebody could be put on license? Who did this? Who?
Well, exactly. And also, what was the extent to which they were informed, and was that constitutional? I doubt it.
Mm. Well, if it's this shadowy grey area that's neither state nor organisation, and it's, for want of a better word, religious militias pulling people off the streets and locking them up.
There was a lot of collaboration. And another thing that I've discovered, and people who work on issues of adoption know this well, and of course survivors, so many experienced it, there was a lot of forced repatriation from England. So women who got pregnant frequently fled Ireland because they knew what awaited them. Talking of no place to go, I mean, the state didn't provide any kind of benefits for single mothers until the mid-1970s. So all there was for you was state-sponsored incarceration and forced separation from your child. So women fled to England, and there were these lay organisations often waiting at the ports or doing the rounds in London, and they would catch women and put them back on a plane or on a boat to be collected at the other end, to be put into a mother and baby home. And there was Department of Foreign Affairs knowledge of this, which we've seen in the papers. So the Royal Irish Academy publishes the Department of Foreign Affairs foreign papers. And what you see in those papers just shows why it is an absolute travesty that the general state papers relating to the Magdalen laundries and all the institutions are being held secret.
That's right, yes.
And you can't get to the bottom of those structures.
And one of the points you made, the last time I saw you speak, was in relation to the eventual, I want to say settlement, but it was never really a settlement. It was more of an apology was given, an offer of some form of compensation, but I don't know if compensation is even the correct word. It was almost the state's gift. Am I right?
Yeah, is this for the Magdalen survivors? So yeah, so in 2013, Enda Kenny issued a state apology to survivors of the Magdalen laundries, and then he said, you know, he'd been so moved by speaking to the women that he was going to set up what they call an ex gratia scheme of restorative justice, which is, you know, a contradiction in terms, because ex gratia means given as a gift.
Yeah.
Restorative justice means acting in a way that clearly acknowledges your wrongdoing and asks for forgiveness in return. Like, you can't have restorative justice where you haven't accepted your responsibility. But legally speaking, the state always insists on giving this form of compensation ex gratia. It's a Latin term. And like, really, it's failure to produce records. It's refusal to actually investigate the abuse, because the Mackley's report was actually only a report on state involvement with the institutions.
Yes.
Like, its failure to ensure any accountability totally undermines the restorative element of any kind of money that's given. And what they did with the Magdalen scheme, which is very common in their schemes when they give out payments where there's been great scandal, is they made the women, in order to get their money, sign away all their rights against the state so that they can never take the state to court.
Yeah.
So that kind of copper fastens.
Say that again. They made them give away
all their rights against the state.
I heard you say that before, and I just keep playing that over my head.
And it's not necessary, because let's say someone did get money from the Magdalen scheme and then went to court. If they ever got awarded damages by the court, the judge would just take away the amount that they'd already been given by the state.
Yes.
So it's a way of copper fastening the state's impunity. Like, it will never have to do discovery in a court case. And that way it can say, as it does now, no, we're not ever releasing the files on the Magdalen laundries that the state holds. And they know that no one will be able to take them to court to force them to do otherwise.
But even the structures that exist in our judicial system, they're not structured to take on the state in that sense over the Magdalen. It's simply
not
structured.
Well, the courts in themselves, like, are perfectly well capable of doing it. The problem is you can't get there because there are laws prohibiting you from taking cases beyond a certain number of years after you've suffered a personal injury, for example. So, like, these are the kinds of technical, you know, some might say boring details that actually, you know, allow all of this abuse to go unchecked. And I would say, you know, allow it to definitely happen in the future.
You would think that that's an absolute crying out for a class action. So you would
there's
think
no class action legislation,
yes, exactly,
in Ireland.
That's
so
right.
There's a
that's
number
right.
of, yeah, so no class action legislation in Ireland. There's a very short time limit for personal injury cases or constitutional actions. In England, they actually have an exception to the statute of limitations where the courts feel that there's sufficient evidence to allow a fair trial and that it's equitable, weighing up both sides to allow the case to proceed. Bearing in mind, like, you still have to prove your case. Mm. So, for example, in 2012, a group of Kenyan victims of torture and the Mau Mau community obtained a significant settlement for torture they'd experienced in the 1950s at the hands of British forces, because there was a huge state archive available that proved their case. And the judge said, well, it's equitable to allow this to go ahead. And then the government, realising that they were actually going to have to go to trial, settled. We don't have that exception to the statute of limitations. Then there is the costs regime. So, like, I think people coming from America, for example, just, like, wouldn't be able to get their head around this. In Ireland, as we probably all know, if you take a case against someone and you lose it, you usually have to pay the costs of the other side having to defend the case. But of course, if you've got a case about something that no one has ever challenged before, there is a great risk of losing it. And you might ultimately win at the European Court of Human Rights.
But
first of all, you're going to get advice from your lawyers. You're really at risk of losing this case.
Yes.
And the Irish state does come after you for costs.
Absolutely.
And so do the nuns. Mm. And they will. And they write very threatening letters. Drop your case now and we won't come after you. We won't take your house. I, like, naively thought that Magdalen Laundry survivors had been too intimidated, too silenced, to ever go to lawyers to speak about what had happened to them, to try and seek redress. But when I went to London in 2012 and started to interview women who'd been in Magdalen Laundries, they had gone to lawyers, and the lawyers had said to them, well, you now have a house. You've worked so hard to get a roof over your children's head. Like, I would not advise at all taking a case because you stand to lose that house. And Louise O'Keefe is the case in point. Such a brave woman. She took a case against Ireland for abuse, for failing to protect her in the 1970s from sexual abuse by her national school principal.
Teacher. That's right.
She lost in the High Court and then she lost in the Supreme Court, but she actually won at the European Court of Human Rights. So she was vindicated. She was right. The state had failed to put in place any form of system for responding to complaints by parents about the national school teachers. They were always directed to the Board of Management, the parish priest.
Yes.
But when she lost in the High Court made an order for €500,000 costs against
now,
her.
Now, there was a judge can choose that if something's in the public interest not to.
Yeah, they can choose.
They can choose
the
not
Max
to.
The Max Strems case was the first time
that's right.
That a protective costs order has been made in the Irish courts. So yeah, they can be made. And I mean, it is something that people will hopefully start to try. I think that the GDPR presents a really good opportunity for trying to challenge this, like, refusal to give over any evidence. Now, obviously, GDPR only relates to personal files.
Yes.
But, like, I was talking a minute ago about how the Department of the Taoiseach actually won't give over anything contained in the MacLeish archive of state documents relating to the Magdalen laundries. That's the administrative stuff. Like, people can't even get their personal files. Mm. Adopted people can't get their personal files. You know, we've heard stories, and Conal O'Faherty, the Examiner, has written loads about how mothers who had their children stolen from them can't get their files. So I think that the GDPR, and in particular the provision that allows non-profit companies to take cases on behalf of people, which will shield them from costs and also shield them from having to reveal their identities, that could offer a really significant
really interesting thing that's opening up, and I am watching to see what happens with it. We're on the precipice of some big things coming this year. We have CHUM, of course.
Yep.
We have that coming.
CHUM being only one of many sites like it. For some reason, the government has it as the pinnacle, and it is the thing that forced them to set up a commission of investigation. But of course, it's not the only site like it. And also, the Mother and Baby Homes Commission is only investigating 18 of what Adoption Rights Alliance estimates to be about 170 institutions, agencies, and individuals involved in adoption.
And it is. I saw something recently. So this is. We're being drip-fed information about this at the moment. We're not getting a big picture, but we're getting some fairly well-known or previously well-known individuals and organizations involved in this. So there's a lot of power at play, a lot of history at play here too. How do you see this developing through the coming year?
Well, the deadline for the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation is February of this year to report. It's not clear whether they'll be delayed as a result of CHUM or what they'll do. I think it's quite strange that there has been just this focus on CHUM, because there are unmarked graves all over the country. And, you know, we've made submissions to the Commission Investigation. I've been working with Adoption Rights Alliance and Justice for Magdalen's research through something called the CLAN Project. We did make the point that there are Magdalen laundries, unmarked graves as well. Like, this is an issue that is far bigger than CHUM. For some reason, the Mother and Baby Homes Commission just took on CHUM, and the issue of, I don't actually really know, because the terms of reference of the Mother and Baby Homes Commission expressly state that it is not there to identify people, to trace family members. Whereas it does seem to be assuming responsibility for what's happening in CHUM. So I don't really understand how those things are working together.
Can I ask a question to something that you said earlier? You said about corporate power. You said about the third parties that were involved in historical malfeasance, I'm going to use the word. We now have a situation in Ireland that we have a structure like direct provision, and we have structures like family hubs.
We'll call them homeless hubs, Tony.
Yeah, we were lucky enough a year ago to sit down around this time last year with Mary McAuliffe, and she was the one who said, look, we just warehouse our poor, and we warehouse particularly women and babies.
Yeah.
I think Mary's given a lecture on Saturday.
She is, yes, she is.
And we warehouse people with disabilities as well, and older people. I was listening back to your episode with Susie Byrne.
Yes.
And it really resonates. I did my PhD just there on older people and their experiences of torture and ill-treatment and the deprivation of liberty and arbitrary detention, including in chemical means as well as physically, is really shocking.
And Susie talked about that, about, you know, putting people on the outskirts of a town, putting them in this home. Basically, it is a form of confinement. And what we're doing in terms of the direct provision system, and I keep seeing, and this is not to pick on, but just, for example, Aramark, we're running some of these businesses, and you're going, what accountability do they have, as you know, to the state? Because they're corporate entities. They're for profit.
Yeah, I know. I do find it very disturbing. I think that institutionalization is maybe the, if not certainly, one of our top defining human rights violations as a state. I've heard you guys both talk about the statistic that Owen O'Sullivan and Ian O'Donnell produced, which is that in 1951 we were incarcerating more than 1% of the Irish population, which is almost, if not the highest in the world at that
time.
Worse
than the Russian gulags.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that the picture is that much better these days, because institutionalization is our response to the needs of people who have, you know, needs for care. And it's such a denial of rights. And we're still, like Susie Byrne was talking about, we still have this attitude that people who need care are charity cases, that mm-hmm. we can do with them what we want, and they don't have recourse, and they really don't. And that's where the accountability and the lack of accountability structures comes in. So, like, you know, are direct provision providers public bodies for the purpose of the European Convention on Human Rights Act 2003, which requires every public body to comply with your rights under the European Convention on Human Rights, including, you know, your right to respect for private and family life? A few years ago, a Northern Irish judge refused to extradite a family back to Ireland from Northern Ireland because they would end up in direct provision, and he said it was a violation of Article 8 of the ECHR for the children, because those conditions were incompatible with the right to respect for private and family life. But then, like, other accountability, you know, issues. So where are their records? You know, they're not bodies that are subject to the National Archives Act, for example, and they should be. So this is why, you know, dealing with the past is absolutely vital to our ability to prevent abuses in the future. And it's what we're not doing. The state apologises and then throws money at victims of so-called historic abuse and refuses to allow them to tell us what they know and to teach us about how to prevent this in the future, and refuses to open its archives so that we can see how did we allow this to happen. There's no independent inspection of direct provision centres. I was reading a long article from the Examiner yesterday that I found very disturbing, because it was talking about how the Department of Justice had responded to the Examiner when it had gone saying, you know, people are complaining of very poor conditions, of neglect, of various forms of abuse. And the department just said, well, we haven't really received complaints. Mm. And it really reminded me of the Magdalen Laundries and what they say about the Magdalen Laundries. We know that the complaint system isn't independent. They say, you know, it's the RIA, the reception and integration agency that go. We know from the NGOs that work with people in direct provision that they announce their visits in advance, that you always know when they're coming because the place starts to look, you know, be spruced up. You know, windows are being cleaned, walls are being painted, flowers are being potted outside. And crucially, the food is much better the day that they come. So it's the people who are providing the service who are inspecting it. People are afraid to complain. I think it's maybe somewhat better now. We know there was a massive problem in the past of transferring people who made complaints, transferring them to different direct provision centres. And something that I thought was just straight out of the Magdalen Laundries was the Department of Justice, or else it was the Examiner journalist, said the inspections focus on health and safety only. Mm. And so for ages researching Magdalen Laundries, I thought these places weren't subject to inspection. And actually, the government kept saying, like, it was its legal excuse for the Magdalen Laundries, oh, we didn't actually regulate or inspect. Well, the McLeese report found that actually they were inspected. But what the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission notes is that the factory's inspectors only looked at the health and safety issues. They literally looked at the machinery, just like I'd say the people going into. Yeah, like, not, how are these people living? Oh, like, these people are locked in. No, so in direct provision, they're probably checking, like, are the floors clean? They're not considering things from a human rights perspective. Are these people essentially de facto detained? Yeah. They have no travel pass. They are having to rely on the manager giving them, like, enough soap to last a certain number of weeks.
Yes.
It just absolutely lends itself to the most appalling abuse, not to mention the fact they never know when they're going to get out of it.
Well, that very much ties into to what Tony and I talk about quite frequently, and you've mentioned quite a few times the state, but we are the state.
I know.
We are the state. So what is the problem within us that allows this? Now, Tony and I bat it about and we talk about it. And to me, it is this over-dependence on this central view that everything's okay. We're ticking along quite nicely as we are.
We only saw today the state talking about our first budget, mm-hmm. our first budget surplus, the first exchequer surplus since 2007. And sure, it's all rosy. And I want to caveat that it will completely get to this point, because this is what we wanted to talk about in 2019. We keep talking about it. You've said about, because what you're talking about is structural violence
yeah.
in a way.
Yeah.
There's also over 50% of households in Ireland require €112 in some form of social transfer to be lifted out of the at-risk of poverty category based on the OECD's figures, right? Based on, and we don't measure what that means in terms of stresses and strains yeah. for households. We don't. So if we don't, because the state does not want to quantify
yeah.
physical, mental trauma. Yeah, it's trauma. What Grace Dyess talks so
passionately. I think we're all traumatized.
Yes. Yes.
But she talks about trauma and,
like, I think we live in a PTSD society. I think we are constantly traumatized. And we constantly become accustomed to these conditions that are literally unacceptable. They're unacceptable mm. under human rights. They're unacceptable.
I really think, I mean, I'm biased, obviously, bearing in mind the work that I do, but I really feel that dealing with the past, like an actual yeah. truth telling, is one of the most important ways for us to wake up and realize, like, this is our country. We're in control. We're no longer like under the thumb of the Catholic Church and some elite that is working with the Catholic Church. There are laws, and what's been very beneficial to me has been working in a different jurisdiction as a lawyer. So, like, you know, in England, for all that is wrong with it and the appalling austerity, although I do wonder, you know, whether we have even worse conditions, we're just not categorising them as such, and we're not up in arms to the same extent that, you know, there are just more organisations kind of being more vocal in England. But, you know, there are statutory rights to social care mm. and housing. You know, like, you know, it's not actually true to say that there is no human right to a house. Like,
there is a UN human right.
There is a yes. UN yes. human right. There's also, like, even under our own constitution and the European Convention on Human Rights, both of which are very focused on civil and political, like, at a certain point, things turn into, you know, a complete violation of your right to respect for privacy and family life, degrading treatment even, you know, when it's that bad. But even on a regular kind of social rights level, you know, there's a Care Act, for example, a 2014 Care Act in England and Wales that gives every adult a statutory right to an assessment of need and then a right to the services that they're assessed to need on a means-tested basis. And there are whole law firms that specialise in taking cases then under their Human Rights Act, which is the equivalent of our European Convention on Human Rights Act, saying to a local authority when it refuses to give you the housing provision that you're assessed to need or the disability services that you're assessed to need, they actually sue and they say, you assess me to need this, you've decided not to give it to me on irrational grounds, and you're violating my right to respect for my private life or my family life. You know, there are these cases we all learned about in law school where people were turfed out of their nursing home and they managed to, you know, sue, and these social care institutions are termed public bodies for the purpose of the Human Rights Act. Like, it's just not right to say that we can't put these rights in law.
We have a three-part trick going on here as well, because we have the state, the Taoiseach only 2 days ago talking about delivering 20,000 housing solutions.
Yeah.
That's a dangerous thing. He's been allowed to say housing solutions, not homes.
Yeah, not homes.
Not houses, not apartments. He's saying solutions.
Which means beds, Tony. It doesn't mean homes. It simply means beds.
But my point is, you know, like, I saw Colette Brown pointing it out, and I know I banged yeah. the drum about it pre-Christmas about how the fudge was in with the statistics. It was clearly they were building up to this, revealed in Ireland hasn't failed because we've got housing solutions, not homes. And that's simply a breach of people's human, basic
yeah,
human rights.
It is.
That
yeah.
truly is. And we let this stuff, we do tolerate it. You say in the UK yeah. now, I remember Theresa May at her last, Tory party conference actually started on the rights of, we're going to get back building homes. I've put aside $3 billion for the state to build homes. And I thought to myself, wow, we have the Tory party and the junior Tory party here who doesn't want to build homes.
But I think you're wrong to say that we tolerate it, Tony. I think as a society, we do more than tolerate it. We do much more than tolerate. We actually say, if you want to know answers to these questions, or if you're demanding your rights in this particular way, you're a populist. And as a populist, yeah. you don't feel centrist politics, and therefore we don't listen to you.
I think we're really lacking in a culture of human rights and in the language and in the feeling like it's an acceptable demand to make.
And you know, we were the last country to adopt the UN's people with disabilities rights. And then we didn't bring them the optional protocol because the state didn't want to be able to held accountable.
Yeah, but they did actually light up a building, Tony, and that's to do us again until next year. I mean, it's so cynical.
Yeah, in the ICCL, we've been working for years on trying to get the state to ratify the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture, which, yes. going back to my point about institutionalisation being our major problem and arbitrary detention, this optional protocol has been signed by the vast majority of European states and most countries in the world, and were ratified.
Some of the ones that you'd be surprised at.
Yeah, and it requires independent inspection of all places of deprivation of liberty for the obvious reason that they're the places that you're most likely to experience ill treatment, and no one knows that more than the Irish people. Mm. And yet, still haven't ratified it. Like, we are really lacking, even though we like to think of ourselves, and we do very good work at the UN in some ways on human rights issues. Mm. I find it really baffling.
Well, there's a domestic blind spot.
Can you remember, was it 18 months ago, 2 years ago, where Dr. Jim Gray became the story because he said that one of the cases of, I think it was, I'm going to speak about it, it could be wrong, I think it was a lady in her 90s sitting on a trolley for X number of hours with, you know, he outlined what it was in terms of strip lighting and all this, and he actually equated it to the cruel and inhumane
the definition
of torture. But he became the story because Leo Varadkar himself actually came out and attacked him and said, this guy is a troublemaker. And
we don't listen to people and let them, the state does not accept, acknowledge, listen to the voices of people who experience human rights violations. We had to bring in Justice for Magdalens, and along with Wendy Lyon and KOD's Lyon solicitors, and a number of the Magdalens survivors themselves went to the Ombudsman about what he then found to be maladministration of the Magdalen Laundries ex gratia scheme. And one of the problems was that a lot of the women who applied were given money reflecting far less time than they said they had been in Magdalen Laundries. And the Ombudsman actually found that their own testimony was not considered evidence, wasn't given any evidentiary value whatsoever by the Department of Justice, that they relied solely or sometimes primarily on not even records necessarily from the nuns, but emails or correspondence saying we've checked and they were in for this number of years or from this state to the state. And the women's own testimony was not given any evidentiary value.
Which brings me to a really important point. It's something you're very passionate about. And I'm going to tell it from my own selfish perspective. I told you this before, Martin, I might have said it before, about walking along a canal with a historian in Amsterdam. And he pointed, he said, that building there, you see the logo, that's the East India Trading Company. You see the one further down, that's the West Indian Trading Company. See all these lovely buildings, they were built from slavery. And I'm walking with my kids and we're walking along and he's giving it the whole, and we were very efficient at no other country processed as many Jewish residents as we did, and he talked about their history, and they owned it, okay, and they owned it. We don't have anything like that in Ireland. We spoke about that previously with Gary Gannon and the work that you helped him with as well in preserving the last laundry, as we call it.
Yeah, we've made one good step.
Yeah, one
Fingers
step.
Fingers crossed we'll end up with a place of national education.
There you go.
That's in Sean McDermott Street.
And wouldn't it be great if that could become something that we were able to say, well, here's where we can own our history, where we can take our children and speak and say.
It will be a national disgrace if it doesn't. It will be a national disgrace if there is nothing to remember the thousands upon thousands of women and children that went through that Magdalene system. If it's just expunged from memory, nobody knows about it anymore, it dies. That last building, it goes with it. That's it. And it's like a festering sore that's going to be there till the very last person who remembers about it dies, and that's it.
And a lot of survivors have talked about the need for it to reflect all of the different forms of abuse. Yes. You know, and we haven't even started to talk about the psychiatric institutions. Oh, and then we've got everything continuing to this day, you know, that Susie talked about, indirect provision, the separation of families due to homelessness. There's no doubt that children are being taken away from their families because their families can't manage to provide for them.
Yes, poverty. You know.
Yeah, it is really horrendous. I think in kind of legal things that I think would help, legal aid for human rights cases, I think is so important and could be done in the morning. I think we could definitely do with a human rights Oireachtas committee, you know, a special one dedicated to human rights issues. One of the things about that is that it would have, you know, it would bring things out into the open. So something that I'm very passionate about because of my experience of how the so-called historic issues are investigated is that most of our investigations into malpractice and structural violations of human rights happen in private. Mm-hmm. Everything from GSOC investigations to the current judicial inquiries under Section 42 of the Garda Act 2005 relating to past, you know, malpractice, it seems, in the investigation of deaths, to all commissions of investigation, it would seem. I mean, whatever happened to the Grace case investigation?
Yeah.
The current Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation is proceeding entirely in private, has rejected every request for a public hearing, rejected the ones that I submitted along with the Clan Project without giving any reasons, refuses to give all the witnesses a transcript of their evidence. Obviously, the MacLeese investigation happened in private. The Department of the Taoiseach is refusing to release any of the archive, saying it's holding it for safekeeping and not for the purpose of the FOI Act. Even the Ryan Commission, I know I keep going on about the historic, but it does illuminate even the present. The Ryan Commission that did such good work, that produced such a stark report in 2009, practically no prosecutions happened because, as the Department of Justice keeps telling the UN, the legislation underpinning it didn't allow any of the evidence to be given to the guards.
Yes.
And now the Department of Education has produced a heads of bill that proposes to take the entire archive and seal it for the next 75 years.
Oh my God.
So like we really need a change in the procedures of all investigations into state malpractice. Mm. It's not how things are done just across the border. Again, in England, having private inquiries, particularly where the victims themselves are next of kin of people who've died, where they can't even see the evidence being examined, where they can't comment on it, where they can't give the judge or the investigator questions to ask, it appears to me to be entirely contrary to your right to an effective investigation under the European Convention on Human Rights.
Well, in a country where we have historic scandal after historic scandal, the fact that we have no prescribed way to deal with these scandals.
But the state has a very clever prescribed way, which is to bury it.
Yeah, but we have
and no... And then once you do it in private...
Yeah, but we have no prescribed way to openly, properly deal with anything. And considering the volume of stuff that we have, then you have to look at it and say, well, it's actually policy not to deal with it.
Oh,
it is actual policy not to. Yes, by design, it's policy.
And then the government says, oh, but we're protecting the victims because they want privacy. But not all victims want privacy. And victims who do want privacy, of course, you should protect it. So, you know, not all the hearings have to be in public, but everything should not be in private. And, you know, things that should be in the National Archives, it seems to me, whenever there's an investigation, they seem to get swallowed up and taken out of the National Archives. As far as I can tell. So most of the stuff relating to all these institutions should just be sitting there. But
we've talked about this before, and someone said to me, you know, we talk about left, right and all this other stuff. And we do. We say it all the time. And the reply we always say is, well, why not have a rights-based society?
Yeah, you know, rights-based.
Let's drop the nonsense of do I live in an economy or do I live in a society? Well, let's just put the people at the centre of it. When I was asked about the future of the EU, Martin, at one of our live things, I made the comment that it would be great to see an EU constitution that gave the citizen the rights as opposed to the free trade agreement that we talk about over and over and over.
But that's not a revolution, that's an evolution. It's not revolution, it's evolution.
But there is actually a lot of EU law already. The EU Charter is very strong. The ECHR is quite strong. Even the Irish Constitution is quite strong. The problem, in my view, the primary problem here is people not being able to get into court. And then because they're not able to get into court, it's all too easy for the state to then do its own kind of inquiry outside of court, which it actually uses to gather up and bury all evidence.
Yes.
So greater access to justice, I think, is really key. And when it comes to people who are, say, in institutionalized settings, access to advocacy is absolutely essential, you know, in order to even make your way to then go into court with a lawyer. These are basic foundations of democracy, access to justice, rule of law. Mm. And we are hugely lacking in Ireland in them.
Well, I think they got a little feel of it when no fall, no fee was allowed. And it scared them. And it scared them an awful lot. It scared them so much that they said, no more, no fall, no fee. And that wasn't to protect the individual. That was to protect the state. And that was to protect the state. When you have somebody who'll go no fall, no fee, if your case is 50-50, you'll get a chance in court, which is only fair and only right. I know firsthand what it's like to deal with on rights issues to try and deal with the judiciary. It's the costs every single time. It's the costs. And I've been on the steps of the High Court and been told, if you go in and this goes against you, you're buggered. Yeah.
It's access to the courts, and it's also the statutory rights in the first place in the area of socioeconomic issues, I think.
Access to justice requires
the existence of rights in the law.
Poor people need access to the courts, and that's really it. I mean, rich people have access to the courts, but poor people don't have access.
Which is why we're worried about defamation in here all the time, because it's only the rich people we can defame.
Well, I have to say, this conversation could go on for hours.
And an Oireachtas Committee on Human Rights.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
That's not a bad idea. I mean, Shannon had only dealt with human rights, it'll be doing 10 times more than it is moment.
I'll be dropping a few texts this evening.
Thank you so much for coming in and having a chat with us. We could do this for hours because it's really interesting stuff.
Can I say, you've done great work in the Irish Council of Civil Liberties, and you're moving on to NUIG now in a few months' time. And it's going to, you know what? Lucky students. Lucky students. Because I think your passion for what you do is a testament. And, you know, we don't want to go completely over the top, but really.
You have a couple of fanboys here.
And I should say before I go that if anyone, you know, is interested in further information about all of this, there's the Adoption Rights Alliance. These are the, in addition to the ICCL, and I've always for the last 9 years done voluntary work for Justice for Magdalene's Research and now Adoption Rights Alliance. They both have private Facebook pages and they both have really informative websites. And then the ICCL and Amnesty International and the National Women's Council have all done great work as well, kind of pitching in and all of them advocating together in these issues, which is just going to become more and more important. I really feel that it's the way forward. Yeah. By dealing with the past, you actually manage to get a grip on what your current structures are.
Yes.
But thank you for having me.
It has been our pleasure to have you in, honest to God, it really has.
Thanks folks for listening. We really hope you enjoyed that. Martin, you're not wrong. We could go on for another
hours.
But look, thanks for listening, guys. We will leave it there. Do us a favor, will you? Just have a look at the Patreon account. We're trying to make this thing work.
New year, we need some funding. We love doing this project, but we need to be able to keep it going. It is costing, and I don't mean it's costing me, it's costing Tony an arm and a leg. Arm and a leg. So please, chip a few bob in and we'll get this thing even better.
Thanks. Talk to you all soon. Bye bye.